what we've heard and also what Natasha said is that this was the very first time that this effort was undertaken, and it was an enormous effort to reach out to find and locate people in the 27 countries to move forward and to begin to act as the eyes and ears of what's happening in their countries. So as we move forward, we've learned a lot in the whole process of how to do this. First, figure out how to move my presentation forward. I think that the you've heard from Anna about all of the different policies that were able to be collected in the FDA monitor, but in addition to really being able to assess the actual articles, the monitor was asking questions about other areas. I wanted to show this model. It's a model that we've been using at the Institute for Global Tobacco Control to look at national capacity and for tobacco control. And in the monitor, we had questions to really assess what kind of capacity the countries had to really implement their tobacco control program and policies. And you heard from Anna about the evidence and the other kinds of data that we collected in the monitor, but it's also important to look at, as I said, the infrastructure. And another component that is very, very important is how well the countries are working together. So we were looking at the non-governmental organizations and as well as government to see what was going on in their countries. So in my presentation, we're going to be looking at, national capacity and going into some of the other components that Natasha mentioned about beyond the numbers and a little bit about the tobacco industry interference, which is a real strength of the monitor because they can really report what is happening in the countries with industry interference. So on national capacity, there were questions asked, for example, does your country have a national plan? And it's an important component of capacity if the governments can come together and work with the other organizations to develop a plan of action. And here you see that of the 23 of the 27 countries that participated in the monitor, they said that they had a tobacco control office and a focal point. And we had a number of them said that they had a national plan. 15 said they had an interministerial committee for tobacco control. And as I said, 19 said they had a plan of action over here. And you can see it by the different regions who was able to report at least having a plan. Now, when we began to look in the data that they provide, they said they had a plan, they said they had an office, and here we looked at what does it really mean? Is an office really an office? So, for example, Canada said that they had an office, and true, they had a very, very well-functioning program, many different components of it. And then we look at a country like Japan, and they had one person dedicated to tobacco control. And I think you'll see something through this whole thing about Japan as a high-income country where there's almost no tobacco control going on at all. And in Bangladesh, they had the minister assigned tobacco control as an additional responsibility to someone who's overburdened with other kinds of responsibilities. So they don't even have a full-time person working on it. Some of the other countries, the tobacco control office was in the Ministry of Health, and that was in Thailand and Fiji and Canada. As I said, other countries in the Ministry of Health, like Bangladesh, India, and Sri Lanka, there really was maybe one person who was really dedicated, if that. Most of them had other responsibilities that they had to do. So I'm going the right way. So the other thing that we wanted to look at, besides the tobacco control capacity, we asked the data collectors to identify what kind of improvements, what were the three main improvements in tobacco control that was occurring after the FCTC went into place. And their answers are displayed here and listed as an improvement either in capacity, policy, or both areas. And you can see in high-income countries, they felt they had the capacity and they were moving forward with their policy. In other countries, that you could see that they're still trying to build their capacity. Now, the capacity improvements that they were interested were creating a national plan, getting at least a campaign going, creating a national even a cell, a small group working on it, if not a focal point, if they couldn't even get an office, and really trying to get some funding and beginning to do their own surveillance and research. In the policy improvements, they were looking for enacting other types of legislation. So, as I said, the high-income countries had really were working on their mix of policies, and the low-income countries really still had to work on their capacity. For example, can you describe their capacity improvement? Now they had a dedicated office after the FCTC, so, and they had the beginning of a budget, so there were some improvements in that for them also. The other question we asked the data collectors to look into to generate a list of the greatest needs they had for tobacco control improvement. And again, we looked at the practical capacity needs, looking at areas such as funding, surveillance, national plans, as I said, and the policy needs again. And in here you can see basically the differences between the countries, again, needing to improve their capacity. For example, Mongolia's greatest need was to establish a national intersectoral coordinating body that would provide leadership and comprehensive tobacco control strategy. So they really needed to make improvements in that area. Now, the other thing we asked for was to report their greatest technical support needs. So these are the different components that they felt that they needed to really improve their tobacco control in their country. And similarly to the other graphs, the data collectors in all but the high-income countries were still predominantly focused on getting support in the areas of capacity building to just be able to do the kinds of things that they needed to do in the areas of media advocacy, cessation, clinical kinds of guidelines, research, and policy development. So they also needed to really have help in drafting their policies. They reported really needing guidance from others to, even if they get it drafted properly, how to implement and then how to monitor these policies to make sure that they really were going to happen. For example, Thailand indicated that their greatest technical need was to continue surveillance system for tobacco control, really being able to measure the burden of disease, really be able to continue to track the tobacco industry tactics and illicit trade. And actually, Thailand, of all the countries, has done incredible work in tobacco control, having an office, having a very large budget to carry out their tobacco control, but they still have technical support needs. The other area, as I said, we were looking at networking as a component of capacity building, and building this aspect of tobacco control really is dependent on collaboration. And this is where civil society in some countries, there is a role. In other countries, they're not really able to participate because there's no collaboration. And 20 of the respondents reported that a coalition of NGOs was engaged in their countries. But then you have to look at it, is it really involving and working with government? So the respondents were asked to respond in a qualitative nature as to the NGO involvement in program implementation in their country. So were they really engaged in doing something in program implementation? And 13 of the countries reported that they were highly involved. So they're part of the process. They're allowed to be part of the process in policy development in their countries. And it's especially in the high-income countries where we see the NGOs taking a good role in doing this. For an example of a country that was highly involved was Australia. And a quote from the data collector was, the NGOs research and develop tobacco control policy and advocate to the government ministries and department offices. Their relationship between the NGOs and the government ministers varies by jurisdiction, but in all jurisdictions, NGOs are able to contribute to government decision-making. So that's a very important point, that they're able to contribute. In a minimally involved countries, for example, here, it was India, and their quote was, civil society is rarely taken into the competence of any policy or legislative development. So you see this varying by country as to the role of civil society. Oh, did I go the wrong way? Yeah, I think I did. The next thing is continuing looking at NGO involvement. 9 countries reported that NGOs are highly involved in program implementation, so being able to really go along with governments to say what needs to be put into place and how to do it. For example, we mentioned earlier, you heard about Uruguay, NGOs take a part in the Ministry of Health Tobacco Control Advisory Group and help do advise the government about what kinds of programs. But as you can see here, the NGOs are not able to act in the absence because they don't have enough funding. And here's what Jordan's saying. And then some of the countries there really couldn't even tell us what was going on there. So there's really different levels of involvement in the NGO. And going backwards again. So the other area we were looking at, we found that there were 8 countries that reported that NGOs are highly involved in monitoring programs and policies in their country. And I don't think, if we have time for questions, maybe Laurent and Natasha can also tell you that individual countries are also collecting additional data to put out their own reports. So there's another voice at the country level for civil society to really keep pushing the areas that need to be done. So an example of a highly involved country in helping to monitor is Sri Lanka. Recently, an NGO monitoring and surveillance committee was formed, and they really are part of the subcommittee to move things forward. And Ghana, unfortunately, was a country that had minimal involvement, and here it said they lacked the resources, lacked personnel and technical capabilities to do this. So you can see kind of a pattern where the countries, especially low-income countries, they really need to have more resources to be able to do this kind of work. So we can look at the different types of things that are happening in this area. So one of the other things that they were able to provide us is the constraints they had in trying to get involved. For example, Armenia, here's a quote from the data collector that the NGOs have a critical need. They don't have the skills, they don't have the training to really begin to monitor and to help in policy implementation. So that's an area that could be developed. In Bangladesh, again, as I said, limited funding, they lack of capacity, and also there is a lack of interest. So here, the tobacco control is not really something that is of interest to the broader NGO community. In Hungary, there's insufficient communication and experience and sharing, limited resources. You get in a time when there's not a lot of funding, then the NGOs really compete with each other instead of developing any kind of cooperative network. Norway, as we heard from Anna, is a country that has really substantial tobacco control, but they still have some things that they think are a constraint where there really are not funding any projects in developing countries. So that's something that they thought that they could work on. In Pakistan, the influence of the industry is really substantial and they lack even an NGO culture. And there are countries where they're not even allowed to have NGOs at all. So briefly just mentioning about the tobacco industry interference, one of the things that we were looking at is tobacco industry interference on the program really is the youth smoking prevention program. And I think I found this very interesting because at one point I had been contacted by a YSP program before I knew that it was a tobacco industry tactic, and they had called me on the telephone and asked me some things and were wanting to invite me to something. And luckily, having knowledge, I called some friends and asked about it before I even really continued talking with them. But there are many countries that where we find these programs. There are 9 countries reported that their governments own stock and divested international companies. Some of the countries like Japan, it is the national monopoly, so the 66% of the tobacco industry is the government. And here, as I was talking about the youth prevention programs, 9 countries reported that the tobacco industry runs these programs. In Trinidad and Tobago in 2001, they had a program for underage smoking prevention. It was called Think Twice, Can't Vote. I don't know exactly what it was, Don't Smoke. And in many instances, we know from the research that these programs are highly ineffective. But the governments, it's hard for them to turn down these free, wonderful programs, and they use them extensively in the schools. The other part that Natasha, and I'll go quickly through this because I'm running out of time, and as a moderator, I should stop myself. There's many different things here that, from this beyond the numbers, and this is where this section allowed the respondent to add a national perspective to the report to give context to the individual country data, and it was a chance for them to point out successes or disappointments from their individual country level report. And at the present time, for example, here is India, they said they didn't even have a single officer working on tobacco control. And civil society was not involved in decisions, and decisions were often held up for months and years with bureaucratic difficulties to get some things through. So they have a lot that needs to be done in building civil society and really even moving tobacco control forward. Japan, you heard me mention about Japan. One thing they didn't mention, that there is the national business law that really supports the tobacco industry. And a sad thing that they reported was the Supreme Court decision in Japan that dismissed a plaintiff's appeal on tobacco-related disease lawsuit, indicating that there was not enough evidence to link tobacco use with disease. So that was a very disturbing thing that happened in Japan. And here in Pakistan, they were telling us the placement of a focal person in the Ministry of Health and involvement with civil society has been a major improvement, so things were moving forward, and hopefully they continue to grow their tobacco control. Uruguay has made significant progress in the last 2 years. They were reporting. They had a very strong no-smoking policy put in. But they still have tobacco industry systematically opposing most of the things that are going on. And they really need to have tobacco control advocates join to create and work with them to create a research center. So that was a really good thing that happened in Uruguay, and we heard a little bit about Mauritius. Now, the story in Norway, what they were finding is that they felt that they were at the end of their tobacco epidemic. They felt that they had really handled everything. There was a real decline in smoking. But as I said, currently they do not fund any other tobacco control efforts in developing countries. And one of the things is they still had investment of their national government in international tobacco companies. So that's something, their area that they would want to work on. So in conclusion, one of the areas that is very important is really to continue to understand the capacity and other needs of countries so that we can really understand what's happening there and be able to continue to see growth in these areas. And the monitor has been able to collect some excellent qualitative data. We have some good quantitative data, but these qualitative data have really been helpful in understanding what has been happening, and it's really crucial that they continue to begin to tell their story and allow what's happening in their countries to be able to be told. So the assessing and monitoring of capacity is difficult, but it's important. And in addition, assessing the tobacco industry interference, and we only showed you a little bit, but this is something that the monitor really wants to improve and work on, and because it's a very important role for civil society. And we know that understanding capacity, really capacity is related to changes that will occur in consumption and prevalence, so we really need to understand it and continue to measure it. So this is an important area for the monitor, and I'm going to stop there and turn it over to questions. So thank you.